Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to live in Israel? With President Bush commemorating the 60th anniversary of its establishment, most of the American media coverage of today's Israel centers around its security challenges and political machinations. But while those are important elements of the story, they obscure the reality of more than 6 million people for whom Israel is home. And that lack of coverage makes it easy to forget just how diverse Israeli citizens are, as defined by national origin, cultural and spiritual values, and visions for the future. My guest today would like to help us understand all that. Donna Rosenthal has recently updated her best-selling 2003 book, The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. We're delighted she could be with us for the hour. Donna, welcome to Think.
It's good to be here, Chris.
One thing is clear in reading the book, that Israelis share a love for argument. It's good-natured in many cases, but your book depicts a people who are not afraid to say quite bluntly what they think.
Yes, when you walk by a cafe, if you're an American tourist, you think people are yelling at each other. If you go to the parliament, which is called the Knesset, it sounds like the members of the Knesset are screaming at each other, but in Israel, this high decibel sound is called talking. And it's very much a Mediterranean country in this respect. You see it also in Greece and in Italy. But Israel is a thriving country of many political parties, about 30 of them, and a disparate collection of 7.2 million Jews, Christians, and Muslims who all call themselves Israeli.
And you write that it is culturally really disgraceful to come across as a pushover in Israel, and that it sort of plays itself out in the way people respond to everyday rules and traffic laws and things like that.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, a lot of people are pretty shocked about the Israeli driving. More Israelis die from driving accidents than from terrorism or from wars. The line in between lanes is kind of a suggestion. And partially, waiting in line is for sissies. I recently was interviewing a doctor in a hospital who's a pulmonary surgeon, and he was smoking in front of a no-smoking sign. And when you fly into Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, which I do frequently, I have a family in Dallas, you notice that the cars are parked generally very neatly in between the lines. If you fly into Ben Gurion Airport in Israel, the international airport, you'll notice the cars are on the lines, over the lines, on the sidewalk, in front of the no parking signs. And this is one of the reasons that our computers of the world work, because Israeli ingenuity and not following rules is the reason we have our Pentium and Centrino chips that are in most of the desktop and laptop computers of the world. Those of you that have cell phones, there's a major component of the cell phone that was invented by Israelis working at Motorola in Israel. That's why Google just opened up a second office in Israel. Israel is a high-tech powerhouse that has more startups per capita than anywhere in the world, and more companies listed on NASDAQ than any country outside of the United States. But Israel is 20 times smaller than California.
And there are a lot of people now moving to Israel for those good jobs, and not specifically because of any sort of cultural or heritage reason.
Not so much for high tech, because you make more money in the States, in high tech. But it is high tech, really, and biotech, and is the engine that drives the Israeli economy. We have all these stereotypes about Israel. For example, the music that you played introducing this piece was kind of a stereotypical music. Another stereotype is that Israelis live on collective farms, which are called kibbutzim, and they pick oranges and sing around a campfire. Most of the kibbutzim, the agricultural work in Israel, is done by people from Thailand or China. And it's really places like Intel and Motorola and IBM in Israel that drive the economy.
Your point is well taken, although we play that music all the time. one thing that Americans find so hard to understand, particularly after the trauma that we experienced after 9/11, is how Israelis are able to sort of go about their lives with this constant threat of terrorism. Can you talk about how people cope?
Well, you know, I was when I wrote the book, I interviewed hundreds of Israelis, and I went from bedrooms to boardrooms to playgrounds to army barracks. And recently I was in an army barrack, and scrawled on the wall was graffiti. It said, America 9/11, Israel 24/7. And yet when you go to Israel, you don't feel this heaviness, because there's also a saying in Israel that says, eat your dessert first. So when you go to a disco club in Israel, they don't open at 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock like they do in the States. They usually open at midnight, and Israelis dance until 10 and until the dawn. You go to sushi restaurants and you forget to make a reservation, and at 11 o'clock you can't get a seat. So there is this joie de vivre. However, if you go to a kindergarten or a shopping mall or a wedding, everybody has their bags checked. There are security guards checking everywhere, and that's part of life. And, of course, another part of life is the military. Most Israeli high school kids, whether they're Jewish or, you know, religious or non-religious, are drafted after high school. And Israel happens to be the only army in the world that drafts females.
Everyone except, is it Orthodox women who aren't drafted?
Well, no, there's a few exceptions. Ultra-Orthodox women are not drafted. Ultra-Orthodox men are subject to the draft, but most of them do not serve in the army. They say they have to pray in religious institutions. And so this is a big, a major source of friction between Israeli Jews. Those who are Orthodox and non-Orthodox serve in the army, and those who are ultra-Orthodox generally get exemptions, and there's tremendous resentment. There's another group of Israelis. When Israelis are inducted into the army, they swear in on four holy books. The most common holy book in the Israeli army is the Hebrew Bible. About 78% of Israelis are Jewish. But there's also the Quran. People don't realize that Arab Muslim Israelis are not drafted, but they may volunteer. And some of the most, the bravest fighters in the Israeli army happen to be Bedouin Muslim men, who are, in fact, one of the bravest soldiers that was just killed a week ago was a Muslim serving his army, the Israeli army. And you don't see this on CNN. There's another group of Israelis who are also Arabic-speaking, which, by the way, Arabic and Hebrew are both the national languages of Israel. These are Druze, D-R-U-Z-E. And this is a secret religion that I detail in the book. And Druze are not volunteers in the army like the Muslims. They are volunteers, and they serve in the Israeli army. The Israeli consul general in Atlanta is a Druze. The Israeli vice consul in San Francisco is a Bedouin Muslim. Both of them served in the Israeli army. And then the fourth holy book in the Israeli army is the fastest growing book. It's the Christian Bible. Arab Christians are not drafted, but they are volunteering, not in huge numbers, but more and more. And I wrote the Israelis to smash stereotypes. And a big stereotype is that who are the Arab Christians? And of all Israeli citizens, they are the most educated and the most affluent. And the main reason the Christian Bible is growing so rapidly in the Israeli army is because of the former Soviets. Since communism, the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, Israel has absorbed over 1 million former Soviets, and about half of them are not Jewish.
And in fact, Israel has the fastest growing Christian population of any country in the Middle East. Is that right?
Not only the fastest growing, but it's the only country in the Middle East that has Christian population growing, not shrinking. Christians have been fleeing. Iraqi Christians have been fleeing Iraq. We're talking in the millions of numbers. The Christians of Lebanon. There hasn't been a census in Lebanon since 1932, but they're fleeing. The Copts. The Christians of Egypt are leaving. They're about 10% of the population. So Israel is quite unique, and the Christians of the West Bank, Palestinian Christians, and in Gaza have been leaving. Bethlehem in the West Bank used to be 80% Christian in 1958, and today it's about 80% Muslim. And pretty soon, in the book, I have one woman saying, pretty soon Bethlehem will be a town of churches but no Christians. So I think it's very interesting to understand the many types of Christians that live in Israel, whether they're Arab Christians or Russian-speaking Christians. And the reason I wrote the book is to let Israelis speak in their own words and smash stereotypes.
Donna Rosenthal is my guest. Her website is donnarosenthal.com. Her new book is called The Israelis, rather newly updated book. It's called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. On the other hand, you know, you write about these different religions other than Judaism, but you said that even atheist Jews in Israel lead very Jewish lives in terms of cultural practices. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's a good point. I have a lot of people, you know, don't realize that of the Israeli Jews, about 80% of them are what I call in the book non-Orthodox. About 10% are Orthodox, and about 10% are what I call in the book Jewish, or ultra-Orthodox. The vast majority of the Jews who are non-Orthodox, there's many variations. Some of them never pray unless their football team is losing. It's somebody said to me in the book, in Israel, soccer is not a matter of life or death. It's something far more serious. And then you have some Israelis that keep kosher all week long, and then on the weekends will eat steak levon, which in Hebrew means white steak, but actually it's a euphemism for pork. Or they might go to the synagogue on the Sabbath, on Saturday, and pray, and then they'll go to the beach in a dental floss bikini that you can barely see. So you have all these different kinds of Jews, but Israel has a Jewish calendar. The new year is Rosh Hashanah, usually in the fall. The Sabbath is not on Sunday, the Christian Sabbath, but it's Friday night. So it has, whether you're religious or not, it has a Jewish calendar. When it's Passover in America, it's pretty hard to know it. But in Israel, it's pretty hard to get bread. And buses don't run on the Sabbath in most cities in Israel. So even if you don't believe in God, it's pretty hard not to follow the Jewish calendar because Sunday is like Monday in the United States. It's the first day of the week.
You write, Donna, that kids in Israel tend to be fiercely independent. Would you give us some examples of that?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, it's not uncommon to see a 10 or 11-year-old kid walking alone at night. It's going to a friend's house. Parents know that their kids are going to be going into the army, most of them after high school, so they try to raise them as independently as possible. Plus, even though you see on CNN it looks like all Israelis are in tanks, it happens to be a very safe place. The murder rate of Israel is about the equivalent for the last 4 years of the murder rate of Washington, D.C. since January of this year. So children are raised to be independent, and yet it's a very family-oriented society. Kids, whether they're Muslim or Christian or Jewish, it's very family-oriented, and yet a lot of Jewish children go into scouts, and their childhood friends tend to be their friends through life. It's such a tiny country, 7.2 million people, that almost everybody 6 degrees of separation away from somebody else. So it's very hard to be lonely in Israel, even if you want to be. In the book, I interviewed a woman, and she told me on average 5 times a day she's asked if she's married, and she's in her 20s, and she said no, and then people say, well, why not, or they try to fix you up.
You write about somebody who called an operator looking up an ex-girlfriend, and the operator, the country's so small, the operator said, oh, don't worry about it, she's back with her boyfriend or something, right?
That's right. They say in Israel, as a secret is something you tell only to one person at a time. Because the population of Greater Dallas-Fort Worth is a little over 6 million people. The population of Israel is 7.2 million people. So that's how small it is. And you've got all these colliding cultures, fervently modern people and traditional Jews, Muslims, and Christians, all crammed into this little country, that some parts of it are about the width of a Texas driveway.
Donna Rosenthal is my guest. Her book is called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can join the conversation via email. That goes to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Donna Rosenthal. She has newly updated her 2003 book, The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's talk about the Army some more, Donna. Is it really something you call it, I think, is it a training ground, a crash course in being an Israeli? What sort of common experiences do veterans tend to talk about after they're out of the service?
How much they hate their commanders.
So it's everywhere.
Yeah, well, the Army, it's, and some people call it a people's army. And right now, war, the idea of peace is no longer the ideal, but the absence of war. So barely out of high school, you've got all these teenage kids that suddenly are swearing in on one of their four holy books, and then in their right hand, they're swearing in on their right hand, and their left hand, they're handed an M16 slung over their shoulders. And it's, Israel is so small that soldiers often travel from home to the front lines, a commute that's rarely more than 2 hours, whether you're going to the front with Lebanon and Hezbollah, which in Arabic means the party of Allah, to Gaza, where you have rockets almost every day, many rockets coming in being shot by Hamas or Islamic Jihad. And then they'll go home to their families. And so all over Israel, you have male and female soldiers mingling freely with civilians. And almost all Jewish and Druze families have a full-time soldier or one soldier in the reserves.
And they call their commanders by their first names.
They call their commanders by their first names, their prime ministers, their teachers. It's a very, very casual country. I was giving a talk recently before a large group in Israel, and my cell phone rang, and without thinking, I just answered it in front of the audience. This is something that would be totally rude in America, but my Israeli audience thought that was perfectly normal.
You have another great story about cell phones in the book that I want to tell. When you talk about landing on a plane in Jerusalem after an overseas flight, you talk to a woman, and the passengers were instructed to stay seated and keep their phones off. Can you tell the rest of that story? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the... the stewardess said, would you all please stay seated and turn off your cell phones? And then I think she said, for those, maybe you remember the line.
It was something like, yeah, for those of you who are still seated and are not saying anything, happy Easter and welcome, enjoy your stay. And then they said, for those of you who are already standing in the aisles yelling into your cell phones, happy Passover and welcome home.
Right. In fact, I was recently on a flight to Dallas, and I had just come from Israel, and the man next to me was talking to me, and he said, oh, excuse me for interrupting you. And I said, could you please say that again? He said, excuse me for interrupting you. I said, say that one more time. And he said, why? And I said, I just came from Israel, and no one in Israel has ever uttered that sentence. Because there's a feeling, it's not just Israelis, it's, again, Italians and Greeks, that a pause in between when you're talking around a table means people are not interested. So it's very healthy and culturally acceptable to interrupt people and contradict each other all the time. A place for fantastic arguments.
Yeah, did you, you spent 5 years living and working there, is that right?
Well, I spent 5 years working at Israeli television and Israeli radio as a reporter, and then another 5 years writing The Israelis.
Mm-hmm. So how much of an adjustment was it for you to get used to the culture, having been raised in this country?
Well, I was raised in Texas, so in the Texas country, in El Paso. I went to Israel at a very early age as a teenager. As an American, I found it. I've lived all over the world, so it wasn't as much of a cultural adjustment for me to go. But I'm a journalist, so I kind of like a place where people ask questions, and it encourages you to be nosy. So it's a wonderful place for a journalist. In fact, Israel has more journalists per capita than any country in the world. Reporters are falling all over each other. And Israel happens to get more coverage than China, India, and all of Africa combined. So, even though it gets all this coverage, I find that very few Americans know much about Israel, even though you hear about Israel in the news all the time.
Which is so interesting, Donna, because so many Americans, and I think American Jews in particular, feel very emotionally connected to Israel. Does that feeling go both ways? Do Jews in Israel feel connected to Americans in any fundamental way?
Well, American Jews or to Americans?
Well, I guess to American Jews.
Well, first of all, only about 30% of American Jews, or probably less, there's no official statistic, have ever visited Israel. And in fact, when I speak to groups all over the country, I oftentimes find that Christians know more about Israel than some of the Jews. The number one group of American tourists to Israel are Christians, not Jews, which is quite interesting. I think a lot of Israelis, when they get out of the army, the first place they head to is Ben-Gurion Airport, and they either go to South America or the United States or to Asia. And so I think a lot of Israelis have visited the United States. So they don't have as many stereotypes as a lot of Americans might have. I was recently on a radio show where the radio host thought that Israel is slightly smaller than China. I really had no idea how big it is. And so actually I wrote the book when one of my journalism students got a job at CNN. And he called me up and he said, Donna, I'm confused. Our viewers at CNN are confused. We have footage of Jews who look like Arabs, Arabs who look like Jews. We have footage of black Jews. We have bearded men in black hats with long beards from the 14th century. And we have footage of sexy girls in tight jeans with nose rings. Who in the world are these people anyway? So I wrote the Israelis as kind of a Bible for journalists who cover Israel, but more and more as a Bible for anybody that hears about Israel and really doesn't know who they are. And frankly, the book is doing very well in Israel because a lot of Israelis don't know about the people who live down the street if they are from a different political party or a different ethnic group or a different religion, just like people in Dallas might not know the Mexican or the black or the white family down the street if they're from a different background.
What percentage of Israelis are native-born as compared with immigrant right now?
Well, immigration, the big immigration kind of stopped, the big one in the 90s when the former Soviets came. Israel in the 90s absorbed 1 million former Soviets. That's the equivalent of the United States absorbing the entire population of France. But right now, the majority of Israelis are native-born, what Israelis use the word sabra, which is an Arabic and Hebrew word that is the fruit of the cactus. It means stickly and prickly on the outside and soft and sweet on the inside, which a lot of Israeli Christians, Muslims, and Jews are when you first meet them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is author Donna Rosenthal, whose book is called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. Let's speak to Karen in Fort Worth. Hi, Karen.
Thank you so much for your show today.
Sure.
Very interesting. I just wanted to echo a couple of things that I've heard. I worked on a kibbutz just for 6 months in Israel in the early 80s. And I would love to get back there. I haven't in all these years, but it was just a wonderful experience. But the one thing is I thought it was an extraordinarily safe place to live. I never, even at that age, would have ever hitchhiked through the United States. And I hitchhiked from top to bottom throughout Israel, and it was very safe. I don't know if it's still like that.
Well, yeah, that's what I mentioned about the murder rate of Washington, D.C. I was recently with an Israeli friend at a beach restaurant in Tel Aviv, and it was 11 o'clock, and he had not made reservations, so we got a very bad table. And on the beach, I heard samba music, and there were sexy men and sexy women dancing on the beach. And I said to my friend, David, I said, this reminds me of Rio de Janeiro. It's such a wonderful feeling. And he said, Donna, I've always wanted to go to Rio de Janeiro, but I'm afraid to go there. It's so dangerous.
Yeah. Are Israelis surprised that people are afraid to visit there?
Are Israelis surprised about it?
Yeah.
Well, again, I think a lot of people get their images from television news. And there's an old saying in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. So when you're seeing footage of Israel, you're seeing Katyusha rockets coming in from Gaza or Israeli soldiers who've been captured by Hezbollah. So you're seeing tanks, and you're getting a feeling that it's a very militaristic country where people are dying all the time, and yet they don't show the gay parade in Tel Aviv. Or what I recently had lunch at Intel in Jerusalem, and I was sitting with a Russian-speaking Israeli engineer who had three earrings and hair down to his shoulders, an Ethiopian Israeli electrical engineer who had come from a village in Ethiopia where there was no running water and they'd never seen electricity, and they had been he was on the team that invented the Centrino chip. And there was an Arab Christian woman and an ultra-Orthodox Israeli woman, and they were not talking about religion or politics. They were talking about getting the next computer chip to market. But this is very boring television. There was no blood. And so all these reporters from all over the world that are falling all over themselves trying to get a story really don't cover the side of Israel. That's why I wrote the Israelis as a Bible for these journalists.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. My guest is Donna Rosenthal. Her book is called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. You do have a rather poignant story in the book, Donna, about a girl who's getting her hair done. Her mother says, I'm going to go down the street and get you something to eat. I'll come back and have a sandwich. And there's sort of an embrace, and it's like the girl's telling her mother to be careful, because there is that sense that at any point something could happen. Can you talk about how people live with that reality?
Well, that's a very important question. Right now, the most dangerous places in Israel happen to be within 50 kilometers of Gaza. Almost every day since the Hamas and a coup d'etat took over the Gaza, there have been rockets, Qassam rockets, fired into Israeli schools, fields, buildings. Yesterday, a horrible rocket attack hit the city, not a village, a city of Ashkelon inside Israel, and hit a shopping mall where right into a mother-baby clinic, and injured a mother and her baby and the doctor who was attending them and 80 other people. But this didn't make the news in America. You just saw the... So this is a feeling of every day people that live in these towns, Israeli towns near Gaza. They don't have post-traumatic stress. They have traumatic stress because it's continuing every day, whereas half an hour, 45 minutes away, the sushi restaurants are full, and President Bush is in Israel right now for Israel's 60th, and yet the shopping mall incident happened yesterday. So there is this feeling that high-tech and the economy is doing very well, and yet there could be a war any time. Israel has to do something, according to many Israelis, that these missiles coming in from Gaza cannot continue. And they're very, very worried about Iran. That's, I think, whether you're left-wing or right-wing Israeli or whether you're Muslim or Christian, you remember sitting in your bomb shelter 2 summers ago while Hezbollah, which is a proxy of Iran, was lobbing thousands of Katyusha rockets into Israel. So for 33 days, Israeli Jews, Muslims, and Christians sat in their bomb shelters or in the maternity wards in Israeli hospitals, which were put in basements. And they know that Iran is not going to go away and that Iranian threats they take very seriously.
There are different interpretations of Ahmadinejad saying that Israel could be wiped off the face of the map. There are some people who say that what he meant was not that he planned to attack Israel with a nuclear weapon. Is that, in fact, though, what Israelis commonly believe?
Not only they believe it, but intelligence experts from Great Britain to France to Japan take it 100% seriously. I mean, why does the world's second largest oil producer, the reasoning goes, need to develop these nuclear plants? Plus, they have Shihab missiles that not only can hit Israel now, but they can also hit Europe. And very soon, they'll be able to hit the United States. So Israelis very much remember a book that was written in 1924 that hardly anybody read. It was called Mein Kampf, and nobody took it seriously. So when Ahmadinejad, I'm not saying the Iranian people, I'm saying the millionaire mullahs, especially Ahmadinejad, threatens to wipe Israel off the map, Israelis take this very seriously.
Where hospitals in this country will often give newborns a car seat, for the ride home. It's sort of complimentary with their stay. Every baby in Israel is issued a tiny gas mask at birth. That seems like just an incredibly stark reminder for parents that they're raising kids in a dangerous world. And yet you write that the birth rate goes up every time there's been sort of a major period of conflict. Soon after that, the birth rate rises.
Right, just like in any country after a war. The new babies that were born after the war 2 summers ago with Hezbollah are called the Katyusha babies.
Yeah, because is it a feeling that major stress is over, we might as well just pick up and go on.
Exactly, because it's like people that live on top of an earthquake fault in California, for example. They don't think about earthquakes all the time or you would go crazy. You just go about your life. And maybe it seems so far away. And yet what one Israeli in the book calls the new missile Middle East, and these which has really changed warfare. And I think right now with Iran's proxy, which is Syria, Iran basically controls very much of the Syrian economy, and what's happened in Iran is basically the Hezbollah takeover of Lebanon just the other day. The Lebanese army is kind of like an army of Boy Scouts right now. They really haven't been able to hit back. So Israel is surrounded by, you know, Lebanon and Gaza. It has a peace with Jordan and Egypt, but the Sunni states in the area are very worried about the Iranian growing Shiite crescent.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We can get a question from Elizabeth in East Dallas, maybe get the response after the break. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was calling about a news story that I read a long time ago, but it was after I had been living in Israel, and I was living in Haifa, and it was during the war many years ago with Lebanon. There was an article in the Jerusalem Post that showed two photos. The first photo was of these poor Lebanese children whose bodies had been strewn upon a jeep that had been fired upon by the Israeli army. And the second was a photo of a British journalist who was reportedly paid by Arab forces paying the children to get up off the jeep after he'd taken these photographs. And when I got back to the U.S. quite a while later, I went to some old magazines and found that photo with articles saying things like, look what the Israelis have done to the people of Lebanon. How frequently do you think this type of reporting happens to slant the worldview of Israel?
Thanks very much for your call, Elizabeth. We will get an answer for you from Donna Rosenthal in just a moment. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The book we're discussing is called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Donna Rosenthal. Her newly updated book is called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Extraordinary Land. You can find her online at donnarosenthal.com. So before the break, Donna, we had that question about what appears to have been a fabricated photograph. Can you talk about how often you think that might happen?
Well, nobody knows how often. It's like a lighthouse. We don't know how many ships wouldn't have crashed if there hadn't been the lighthouse. But it's a very important question. In the Israelis, in the book, in the first chapter, I interviewed an Israeli cameraman who shoots for ABC television and Japanese television, and he said that the camera is in many ways, he said, rifles and tanks are weapons, so are cameras. In many ways, the camera is a more powerful weapon, and this is a media war. It's all about creating images to influence world opinion. So sometimes if Israelis are trying to get a weapons depot from Hamas in Gaza or Hezbollah in Lebanon, the shooters are hiding in schools or hospitals or homes. And it's very, very difficult. Sometimes if a journalist is interviewing someone, they're depending on their translator to be accurate. And I've seen examples where translators, and not only in the Middle East, but in other countries, had a political agenda and didn't translate exactly what the person was saying. So I think it's very important to see not only who the camera person is, to see who the translator is, but also the editor of the footage. In Jerusalem, most of the foreign news outlets are in a building called Capital Studios. And I have personally seen editors doctoring tapes. So I think what's very, very important, it's not just in the Middle East, but how important an image can go around the world, and it might not be an accurate image. Same thing with photographs and also with words.
That same cameraman that you write about talks about, you know, I suppose because he's working for foreign media that are mostly interested in these violent images, he's out shooting this stuff on a regular basis. He says he has to almost pretend in his mind that he's shooting a movie so that he doesn't absorb it all.
Exactly. You know, it's like a cancer surgeon, you know, doesn't want to talk about it when he goes home. It is very intense, and that's maybe one reason why Israelis really party hard and drive like maniacs.
Yeah, because there's that sense that there's no point in being too careful.
Yes, and actually some of the biggest deaths in the last 2 weeks have been Israeli kids that just got out of the army and were killed in a jeep accident in Peru because of this kind of wanting to live life and do bungee jumping in New Zealand and going off into jungles in Laos. Four Israelis were just they're missing right now in China. So there's this kind of a feeling of I've got to live life as much as I can you know, it is this intensity of everyday living.
How old are Israelis when they start to get married and have children, typically?
Well, again, it depends what kind of Israelis. It depends for the Jews. Ultra-Orthodox Jews have arranged marriages just like religious Muslims and religious Druze. They do not date. It's either the family or a matchmaker that arranges their marriage, and they get married very young. If you're 21 and you're an ultra-Orthodox Muslim or an ultra-Orthodox Jew, you're getting to be an old maid by 22. For an Ashkenazi Jew, it's very different than a Mizrahi Jew. Half of the Israeli Jews are very different than American Jews. Well over 95% of the American Jews are what we call Ashkenazi, which means their family origins were in Europe. And in Israel, about half of the Jews are not Ashkenazi, they're Mizrahi, or Arab Jews. And these are families, Israelis, whose families lived in the Middle East or North Africa, places like Cairo or Beirut or Damascus. And people don't realize that Baghdad, Iraq, was 40% Jewish in 1917. That in 1950, Baghdad was about 25% Jewish with 56 synagogues. Today there are about 2 Jews left in Baghdad. So these Jews who came to Israel from North Africa and the Middle East had different ways of praying, different melodies, tend to be much more traditional, and they get married generally younger than the Ashkenazi secular Jews as opposed to the religious. So it depends which ones. Christian Arabs get married later than anyone else in Israel, and they have the lowest birth rate. So that's why I wrote a whole book. The ones that really get married the most and the most frequently are Bedouin Israelis. 30% of them have multiple wives, have 4 wives. So when you talked about Israelis getting gas masks, the women after they're born, one man asked for 56 gas masks for his children, and he had 4 wives and many children. So Mother's Day can be a very busy day with some families. Even though polygamy is outlawed in Israel, it's alive and well, especially in the Negev desert.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. I actually had it's a kind of a weird question. I noticed that your guest keeps pronouncing the word Muslim as Moslem, and I was wondering if that's a pronunciation of the word indicative to Israel, or if it was picked up somewhere else, because I've never met a Muslim actually pronounce it that way, and the only time I've ever seen it was in 19th century English literature. And I was wondering if I can get an explanation on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
That's a very good question. First of all, Arabic is an official language of Israel, and my accent is not very good. I have studied Arabic, and I'm a horrible Arabic student. I'm fluent in horseback riding Arabic. I have a horse in an Arab village in Israel. But you're correct. It's pronounced Muslim, I believe. My accent is, I'm sure, quite awful. Israeli Arabs tend to speak what sounds like a Lebanese Arabic. There's different dialects. So you can often tell if an Israeli Arab is traveling in Egypt or Jordan or other parts of the Middle East. They can often be told by their accents, and there's certainly different vocabulary, dialectic. My Arabic teacher is from Baghdad, actually, and there are many words that she doesn't understand that I know from Israeli Arabic. But you're correct about my pronunciation. It's probably awful.
So you said that the official languages of Israel are both Arabic and Hebrew. Does that mean that every Israeli is essentially fluent in both languages?
No, it's not. Arabic is not a required language in Israeli Jewish schools. It's an elective, and unfortunately, a lot of Israeli Jews really don't know Arabic. There's Arabic-speaking public schools in Israel, and to pass entrance examinations to go to an Israeli university, you really have to know Hebrew. So what I find is generally young Israeli Muslims know much better Hebrew than Israeli Jews know Arabic. And in fact, I find that young Israeli Muslims, Christians, and Druze know more about Judaism and know better Hebrew than most Jews in America.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Molly in Fort Worth. Hi, Molly.
Yes. Chris, I noticed at the first of the program, or around the first, you mentioned, asked Donna how she was able to live with all the terrorism around.
Well, I was asking how Israeli citizens live with terrorism.
Yes, let me put it that way. But I would like to point out, I don't want to be a spoiler, but the way that Israel became Israel was through terrorism. When the Zionists were given permission to move in there, they came in and made announcements over the radio, threatened people. They blew up the King David Hotel, killed a lot of Palestinians. And I remember there was a slogan, a land without people for people without a land. And neither of that part of that slogan was true, of course. And the Palestinians were driven from their home under threat and have never been able to get back. They lost everything. And I'd like to have Donna's comment on the beginnings of this. You know, it's really an idyllic state in many ways. I know that. But there's another side to this. And I'd like to say also I'm a Texan born here and many generations here.
Thanks for your call, Molly.
Okay.
Well, if there's Molly, it's an important question, and my book is focusing on the many faces of Israelis who live in Israel today, and history, of course, is very important. There's hundreds and hundreds of books written about what happened in 1948 and the roots of the conflict, and it's certainly not something I can answer in a brief way, but there are many competing ideas about what happened and narratives. There was no such thing as Palestinians that were Muslim. Everybody was Palestinian until Israeli independence. It was called it was a British mandate of Palestine. So everyone that lived in the area had Palestinian papers, Jews and Muslims. And there are, you might not realize, but Jews have lived in the area in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem, or the Palestinian Mandate, who never left the area. There were also Muslim Palestinians living in the area. So it's something very important to know, and it's not something I could really answer in a soundbite. But if you read the book, you'll get a sense of the different realities. For example, some Israeli Muslims say, do not call me an Israeli, call me a Palestinian citizen of Israel. Some of them say, don't call me a Palestinian, call me an Israeli. So there's many, many types of Israeli Muslims and different political outlooks about what happened in 48 and what their lives are like today. Some volunteer to serve for their country's army, and some of them say, I don't like the Israeli flag. It's not my flag. It has a Magen David, a Star of David. and then you'll find Israel has two Islamic parties. The Israeli Islamic Party, one has members in the Knesset, in the parliament. There happens to be a mosque and a synagogue in the Knesset. And then the other Israeli Islamic Party says, we don't recognize the state of Israel and we won't run for office. And the people who live, who vote for this party live largely in a town in Israel called El-Fa'am. It's a 100% Muslim town in Israel. And the mayors for the last three mayors say, we do not recognize the state. And recently there was a poll given in this town of El-Fa'am. If we redraw the lines and you can stay in your homes but be part of the state of Palestine and you don't have to move, we'll just change the border, would you like to be Palestinian? And 80% of the people said, no, we want to remain Israeli. So it's very complicated but very interesting, so I hope you read my book.
There have been, Donna, some experimental communities where people of different faiths live side by side in peace, sort of deliberately. What are they able to accomplish that is somehow more difficult in much of the rest of the country?
Well, there are more and more, but not many, just a few dozen schools which are bilingual, Arabic and Hebrew, where kids go to school together. They celebrate Ramadan, they celebrate Hanukkah, they celebrate Christmas, and they learn about each other's traditions. And these are for parents that want their children to grow up in multicultural schools. These are throughout the country, not many, but the numbers are growing very slowly. And there's one town I talk about in the book called Neve Shalom, the Oasis of Peace, Wahad al-Salam, which has got a name in Hebrew and in Arabic, where by choice Jews, Christian, and Muslim Israelis live together, run the town together, run the schools together. And it's a very good place for American politicians to go for photo ops. It's much more well-known outside of Israel than in Israel. It's a very beautiful town in terms of their ideals. And you can read about it in the book. People try to make it look like a dream and paradise, but in many ways it's not a part of Israeli consciousness. There are towns like Haifa where Jews, Muslims, and Christians have lived together for centuries, and this really is a real oasis of peace. It's not an artificial creation. You go into Israeli hospitals all over the country, and you hear Arabic and Hebrew. In the book, in the Israelis, I have a Muslim Sunni Israeli pediatrician named Yasser Mansour, and he is busy taking care of Muslim and Jewish children, and he writes his prescriptions in Hebrew and Arabic. And he certainly knows more about Judaism than most Jews you'll meet in this country. So these are stories that you really don't see on TV news. And I think it's important in the book that you get to hear the voices of these many, many different types of Israeli citizens. People don't know that 25% of Israeli children are Muslim. And the most common name for an Israeli boy is not David, David, or Yossi, Yosef, Joseph. It's Mohammed.
Donna Rosenthal's book is newly updated and out now in paperback. It's called The Israelis, Ordinary People in an Ordinary Land. Donna, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.